Talk given Sunday, 4th June 1972. One of the world's great shortages is the shortage of love. Human beings through the ages have longed to receive and to give love. And yet, in human history, love has been associated with suffering, with frustration, and with death. This last association is of profound significance. Great geniuses, musicians, poets, and others, through their genius, have penetrated into the meaning of this association of love with death. But in their personal lives, they have not realized for themselves just exactly what is implied in this association of love and death. This realization belongs to the great spiritual teachers. They have understood it and known it. And concerned as they always have been for the happiness in the spiritual sense and the fulfillment of man, they have given great teachings about love. In Christianity, for instance, we find teachings such as love your neighbor as yourself, love your enemies, turn the other cheek, and so forth. Many people regard this as a positive expression, which to them is more valuable, they think, than the so-called negative assertion, which you find, for example, in the Buddhist Dhammapada, where it is said, hatred ceases not by hatred. Hatred ceases by non-hatred. But whether given in the positive form or the negative form, the great teachers fully understood that if love in its transcendence is realized by anyone, or rather through anyone, then suffering, sin, and death are not present. It is a curious thing that these three, suffering, sin, and death, are eliminated where there is transcendent love. Naturally, human beings who have any urge towards the highest would like to develop this love, to acquire it, to become loving. What is it that obstructs us? First and foremost, is it not our assumption that we know the meaning of love? We have a dictionary meaning. But we all forget that dictionary meanings are a verbal formulation of the consensus of opinion or belief or investigation by mortals whose hearts and minds have not realized love in its transcendence. How then can we give a verbal meaning of love which is true to the reality, the supreme reality that man can know of love? So you see, we start with a conditioned mind. We start with obstructions, in a state of confinement, instead of starting in the state of freedom, which really is our natural state. Now, in this connection, we must realize from the start, very clearly, that freedom, love, wisdom, truth, goodness, beauty, virtue, whatever you like, are not matters for acquisition. They are our natural condition. The pure mind, the pure psyche, is truth, wisdom, goodness, beauty. That's its natural state. And remembering that the word physical is derived from physis, the Greek physis meaning nature, the natural state is also the physical state. We are so inclined to separate the physical from the mental and the spiritual. This separation of the physical, the mental, and the spiritual bedevils our living process from birth to death. This is how it has happened with the race of man, this bedevilment, right from the beginning. We talk about the physical body, and then we talk about our minds, our feelings, our insights, our spirits, our souls. We use all sorts of words. And when we use words like mind and spirit and soul, we are using words whose meaning we do not know. Look within. What do we mean by mind, or spirit, or soul, or psyche even, as a matter of that? Do we know what we mean by these things? We postulate them as separate from the body. And this has a peculiar, unwarrantable assumption underlying it. Namely, that we know the body. We know all about it, do we? Has not the race of man been perpetually discovering new things about the body? New things which enables us to see that our so-called knowledge of the body has no limits to it. The great teachers, those who, becoming utterly purified, could see the pure light of truth, those teachers knew just what the word body meant. They saw it as one whole reality. It is true that when they spoke they used current language. They talked as if body, mind were separate. If they didn't, it would have been practically impossible to convey anything to their listeners. But we today are in a different situation. The world has moved on in certain ways, especially through scientific work and also through intellectual clarification with the accumulation of knowledge in all fields. So we are able, at least intellectually, to see that we must regard the world as one whole reality. A whole reality which unquestionably is analyzable, perceived as separate parts, but whose wholeness must never be forgotten by any intelligent person, and particularly by a person who is concerned with the religious life, with holy living. Because there is no such thing as holy living without the vivid consciousness of one total reality underlying it. So now, body, mind, spirit, and so forth are convenient words, and we can continue to use them. But we must use them as far as possible free of this split-up condition in our own mind, in our own consciousness, which separates body and spirit and mind into almost unrelated particulars. This is the difficulty. There are philosophies, and there are many of them, in fact, which will state that the mind or the spirit is contained within the body, that the body is merely a vehicle for the mind or the spirit, or that the self, this peculiarly delusive word, self, is contained in the body. But now consider, have you ever met a self, so-called, minus the body? A body minus a mind? Cannot we see that the living individual could be correctly described as a self-contained whole? The psychophysical organism is a self-contained whole. And there is the extraordinary mystery that this self-contained whole is not just confined to the living body that we see in front of us. It's not confined to that, but it includes the total universe. We being constituted as we are, perceiving through our senses, interpreting with our brains, cannot help but separate out things. But if we are aware of the fact that our existential conditioning makes us see everything as separate bits, then it becomes possible to be intense, more and more intensely sensitive to the wholeness of existence. The unity of the universe. And more, to be able to be sensitive to the fact that each particular of the universe in its self-containment includes the whole universe by virtue of complete and total relationships with all the other particulars that make up the universe. Now you see, it could be easy enough, as I speak the words, to put it down in writing, make a logical structure out of it. It would be easy enough to discuss it, to agree with it, or to disagree with it. All this is interesting. It is useful up to a point. It is intellectual amusement, if you like. But it has no value or significance unless in the innermost deeps of our consciousness we can realize it. That is to say, it becomes a reality for us. In which case, this kind of awareness of the wholeness of being and the meaning of our self-containment is naturally with us. We don't need to think about it. We don't need to have to strive to maintain it or acquire it. You and I have knees and shoulders and fingers. We don't have to strive to acquire them. They are there. That is all. Now, because in this kind of situation, your knee or your shoulder is part and parcel of the body with which you associate the I, the self, as such, one never thinks in terms of, oh, have I got a knee or have I got a shoulder? It is there. You just take it for granted. You take it in your stride. Well, I'm not sure how you can take your shoulder in your stride, but you do. Now, supposing we can grow from within in real conscious awareness that what we call mind, spirit, the other person, the tree, the stone, the stars, the entire universe, all that we already can know, can see, and whatever else there may be, which constitutes the total reality. If we can take all that in our stride as a matter of course, how different human life would be. Our natural state would be one of equanimity, of serenity, of peace, a state of comfort, comfort in the sense of strength, invincible strength because it is absolutely resilient. It would be a life which is the living expression through all time of love and beauty and truth and goodness and all the rest of it in its transcendence. Now, why does it become so difficult to be naturally aware of this? So that the conscious mind doesn't have to strive to be aware of it. So that this unhappy divorce between the so-called conscious and the so-called unconscious mind may be out of the situation, and that wholeness of mind, the totality of mind in its perfection and purity functions freely through us, unobstructed. What is there in me myself which is at the very root of the obstruction? we know very well, that we think, we perceive, we talk, and we behave of the world and in the world as in a duality or a multiplicity. And our consciousness is confined to duality and multiplicity. What is the fundamental duality, the basic duality? It is related to the I consciousness. I, myself, as I say. The person who associates the self with the living body itself is perhaps nearer the truth than the person who talks of a mythical, immortal, intellectually postulated or logically deduced self-entity, a mysterious thing called a soul, a spirit, which is immortal. Whatsoever is immortal is characterized by infinity, by immeasurability, by not beginning, not proceeding, not dying. How then can there be a bit of it which is my possession and belongs to me, my spirit, and goes on carrying my passport with it, whether it travels to heaven or the other place? How can that be? Can I possess any bit of space? Can I grasp it? Can I label it? It's quite impossible, isn't it? And yet I postulate this immortal self-entity as me and cling to that postulate. And I cling to that postulate partly consciously, but very largely unconsciously. Now I do that out of sheer ignorance. The conscious clinging as well as the unconscious clinging takes place because of ignorance. Now if I postulate this self-entity of necessity a not-self springs into existence. For me, in my consciousness, this is the self, all the rest is the not-self. There are other selves, other things. And note very carefully how important and vivid the self is to me, and the not-self is somewhat vague something, relatively vague. So you see, because of that, my entire living process in thought and feeling, in word and in deed, is a self-oriented process. This self-center is the root source of this self-orientation in the process of life. Instead of letting life live itself freely through everything, including you and me. Now, here is the fundamental duality, the very root of conflict And if this duality is present, love or wisdom or anything like that in its transcendence is always obstructed because of this self-consciousness, this isolative self-consciousness. That element of self-consciousness which deals with and takes care of the particular organism through which self-consciousness functions, that part of self-consciousness is perfectly all right by itself. It does its work. But when, through ignorance, it raises up this separation between the self, it becomes an isolative self-consciousness between the self and the not-self, then conflict has begun. And love, wisdom, and all of them have a sad time of it. Have you watched how in nature, apart from man, everything proceeds in an extraordinary harmony? Now, don't let us misunderstand the use of the word harmony in this context. I do not mean that everything is pleasant in the sense we consider things are pleasant or harmonious. We have to get free of our meanings, which are true within the limited context of our personal experience. That is all. But our personal experience doesn't touch the total experience of the universe. Now watch things in nature. I gave the example yesterday, for instance, at our group meeting. There is the wind blowing, and the branches and the leaves sway. There is an interplay. According to the elasticity of the living branch, of the leaf, and so forth, that interplay will go on quite happily. But if the force of the wind becomes sufficiently great and the elastic limit of the branch and leaf are reached and overpassed, then the branch breaks, as we say, or the leaf falls down. But note very carefully, there is no conscious striving on the part of either the wind or the leaf and branch. There is no resistance offered. What we translate as resistance is just the natural manifestation of the actual forces at play. There is no resistance offered by the leaf or the branch. There is no personal desire involved, either in the action of the wind or in the action of the leaf. It's just a perfect, unresisting, consciously unresisting interplay. Now, we can't live like that. We don't live like that. we are concerned consciously with a self-preservation, regarding the self as something separate. Your animal is also concerned with self-preservation, but not with the type of self-knowledge, the isolative self-knowledge that we have about ourselves. So you see, this arbitrary postulate of an immortal self-entity lies at the very root of all conflict. If we can become free of this self-concept, this self-center, then the very source of duality is out. Then no longer do we function in terms of I want, or I desire, or I shall attempt, or I shall give or take or do or anything whatsoever. We don't live in such terms. We don't live in terms of my wife, my house, my book, my welfare, and so forth. And also, we don't live in terms of you, the separate person, your house, your book, your interests. You see what happens then. One is aware of what is conveyed to us by virtue of our constitution as separate people, separate things and so forth. We are aware of all of these as part and parcel of one whole universe. Now, if I am really aware in that manner, can I hurt you? Can I hate you? Can I compete with you? You see how different the situation becomes. Under those circumstances, what else is our life but the natural expression of love in its transcendence? And by the same token, or shall I say a similar token, our minds can function only in terms of wisdom, free of the burden and the conditioning of acquired knowledge, of fixed ideas, of convictions and beliefs. And our hearts could function free of the tyranny of desire, whether we call it good desire, noble, sublime desire, or evil desire. Makes no difference one way or the other. Because the separative consciousness underlying it all is absent. Now it's really very important to see this. Otherwise, we can struggle vainly to live the holy life, to live the religious life. See, for example, when the great Upanishadic teachers affirmed the identity of Atma with Brahman, They affirmed the wholeness of the totality. But they affirmed the wholeness of the totality not as a logical deduction, a merely intellectual postulate, but as something realized in the innermost depths of consciousness. Therefore, they themselves offered no resistance whatsoever to the free and perfect functioning of all that creative energy which is and which gives rise to the appearance which we call the universe. They had seen through this illusion of the isolative self-consciousness raising up and postulating the immortal self-entity. In them there was no self-center. The center was the whole. The center was everywhere. The limits were nowhere. That's how it was. Now this is something which we really must very quietly see for ourselves. And when we see that for ourselves, we will find in our daily life, not immediately, but slowly and surely, we will see that we will live naturally, wholly, physically. To give the word physical its true and pure meaning. We will live that way. And in living that way, all comparison will be out. Because if there is comparison, there is striving of one against the other. That's conflict. It's an expression of hate, in a mild or a fierce form, as the case may be. And we will see, we will experience for ourselves that from moment to moment, life is a transformation out of one transfigured state into a new transfigured state. A state of beauty and perfection all the time. Look again at a plant. You drop a seed into the soil. It begins to come out. And it grows, and it grows. A week, a month, a year, 10 years. 100 years, if we live that long to observe it. But at each stage, we see it in its perfection, in its true beauty. It is wonderful at every stage. There is no comparison. There is no stage which is better or worse, evil or good. It is the whole thing. You see, as and when this inner consciousness undergoes that change, we will not kick against pain, nor will we seek to grab or grasp and possess pleasure. The life process in the world inevitably will produce pleasure and pain for us physically, because the body is constituted that way. If I were like air, let us assume that instead of having a body made up of solids and liquids in addition to gases, I was all gas, you see. Well, if anybody shot me or waved a sword at me or tried to cut me in bits, nothing would happen. I'd be all there, wouldn't I? But constituted as I am, and having the kind of brain and nervous system that I have, I register impressions in terms of pleasure and pain. And this is necessary for the survival of the body and the health of the body. Otherwise, the body would perish if we didn't have this pleasure-pain mechanism. But when I add on to that the psychological, I like and therefore I shall grasp and possess, and the other correspondent to pain, I dislike and therefore I shall avoid or destroy if I can, then all the trouble has started, hasn't it? But if I'm awake in this full and whole sense, I'm not going to rebel against what I dislike, and I'm not going to get bound like a slave to what I like. And when those two elements are out, and remember that both aversion and attachment at their root have this self-center consciousness, when those two elements are out, then there is freedom. One lives in freedom. One lives naturally, wholesomely, not according to our intellectually defined, misdefined ideas of goodness or beauty or what is right or and so on. Now this makes for the whole life, which is a pure life, a true life. And when we live like, when we begin to live like that, we begin to know for the first time what it means to be alive. And the real zest of life is there. That which happens unconsciously in nature now comes into the light of personal consciousness with us. And this organism, termed man, has become free of its subhuman state and has flowered out into true humanity. Because this is the true meaning of the word human. And the whole of life is a creative process then. Not creative merely in our rather poor conceptions, our present poor conceptions of what creativeness means. So now, this is one of our fundamental tasks, to penetrate into the root of conflict, the postulated immortal self-center. Once we do that, all selfishness, all selfness must necessarily dissolve. Consider in the religious sphere how we take to religion and the religious life we get into this pathetic state of fighting the good fight and so forth, all in order that I may go to heaven. I may realize nirvana. I may become liberated, the perfected one, the holy one. But this is absolutely the root of all devilishness. So you see, what it means to live the holy life. Not as an external picture, but what it means in terms of the first and the most important inward realization, not merely intellectual perception. It's true that we have to start with an intellectual perception. That's the starting point. But having started with a true vision from within ourselves, not because I've said it or because it's in the Upanishads or the Bible or any teacher at all, you see, but because you yourself have really woken up to this, oh yes, of course, that is so, then there's no further argument about it. Once you've started like that, then everything else begins to go right because you don't control it or direct it. The natural perfection of the living process does it all. This is something which we all forget. We are all so busy killing ourselves in the name of living. This is true, isn't it? So it's a case of be yourself. But don't define what yourself means. It will grow. When you have planted the seed and the tree grows, who defines that the tree shall grow thus and thus? Certainly not the tree itself. It just is perfectly happy. And it just grows and grows. That's all. So too with us. With an additional dimension. This dimension of mind and consciousness of a nature which has not yet even begun to emerge in a tree or in most animals. We have the power of looking within. We have the supreme instrument of salvation through our conscious cooperation with nature in terms of our power of attentiveness. And there is no such thing as true attentiveness so long as this postulated self-entity is the controlling agent at the back of all our attention. Because you see, whatsoever we attend to will be vitiated by our greed, our resentment, our aversion, our attachment, and so forth, in relation to this self-center. And therefore it will always be spoilt, always untrue to reality. And this is so important. This is the kind of thing that always has been rather difficult to put in words and explain. The world as it appears to us, as we now are, will be a totally different world for us when we see into the heart of things. By first seeing into the heart of oneself. And that doesn't mean merely becoming aware of our particular characteristics and so forth. They just come and they go. Doesn't mean that. One has to see first this fundamental source of duality and conflict, and then harmony is naturally released. Then there will be no striving for love, either to receive it or to give it. Because I can neither, this self-entity, I, can neither receive nor give anything whatsoever, leave alone love. Love is a total reality, just as wisdom or beauty or truth is a total reality, which is of the very stuff of the universe. The cleansing of the mind and the heart, the purification of the psyche, can begin to take place only when we have really penetrated into this self-center, to which unconsciously mostly we cling so hard. Let that be done, and through you, man, all man, finds fulfillment and realization.